From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. As the Maryland General Assembly gets down to work, one issue before them echoes the national debate about police brutality. Should the state law that sets out how law enforcement officers are disciplined in misconduct cases in Maryland be revised to be less protective of police officers? We discuss it with Baltimore Sun investigative reporter Mark Puente. Then, two musicians and artists, Anna Roberts-DeVault and Elizabeth Laprelle, will perform a repertoire of ballads and old-time tunes tomorrow at the Creative Alliance in Baltimore. They'll be accompanied by scrolling panoramas called Crankies. We hear about their work, and they'll play a few songs. Plus, Tom Hall speaks with local poet Charles Rammelkamp about Mixed Signals, his latest collection. Now news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. The General Assembly is likely to debate how police officers are disciplined in Maryland, a debate that may echo parts of the national conversation triggered by protests in Ferguson, Missouri, and Staten Island, New York, of police officers allegedly using excessive force against suspects. Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake and several delegates representing the city are calling for changes in the 40-year-old state law known as the Police Officers' Bill of Rights, which sets out the disciplinary procedures of police departments in Maryland. Interest in revising parts of the law followed the Baltimore Sun's expose last fall titled Undue Force, which examined lawsuits against Baltimore City since 2011 alleging police misconduct and found that the city has paid $5.7 million in 102 court judgments or settlements. The investigative reporter behind that expose, Mark Puente, joins me now to discuss it and legislative changes that may grow out of it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Before we talk about the 74 law, the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, let's talk about your reporting about complaints of police brutality. What kind of pattern did you find?
The pattern showed that officers were accused of brutality after questionable arrests. These cases that we looked at weren't people shooting each other on a corner or drug dealers fighting each other. It was an 87-year-old grandmother, a 26-year-old accountant, a church deacon, a lady selling raffle tickets. In all of these lawsuits, just about all of them, they were charged with hindrance, obstruction, disorderly conduct, and prosecutors later dropped all the charges. A lot of people had broken bones, black eyes, and they sued the city, and they either went to court and a jury awarded the plaintiffs money, or the city settled with these individuals.
And you found some police officers were...
We found some officers were sued multiple times, and during the course of our investigation, the city said they weren't aware that some officers had been sued multiple times until we pointed it out to them because their names kept popping up in our files that we were looking at. And they said they're going to change that. They admitted they had a lax tracking system and they weren't monitoring it very well.
When Police Commissioner Batts was on Dan Roderick's Midday Show last week, he said that most of the cases in your reporting, the incidents behind them were several years ago, and they said basically things have changed. Do you have a sense of that?
When he said that, and the mayor had said that in their initial reaction to our story, we're now looking at their current lawsuits because there's still a significant amount that have been filed, and I'm going through those now as we speak. And I had one story a few weeks ago that I found in there about a horse bit a child, but that wasn't part of police brutality, but there's still lawsuits filed.
The number of cases that you found, unusually high? Normal for a city this size?
Well, compared to other cities, I didn't ask for how many lawsuits were filed in comparable size areas. I looked at the dollar figures. Dallas had paid just the same amount of money, but they only paid out in 26 cases compared to 102 because they don't have a cap down there. They paid out much more per case.
But there were fewer cases, apparently.
There were fewer cases, correct. The cap has saved taxpayers here millions.
Under the 1974 state law, how does a complaint unfold? When a complaint is made before against a police officer?
Well, and it's a resident can file a complaint with the police department. The internal affairs will get involved. At some point, the resident has to swear under oath and sign an affidavit of the allegations. in our investigation, we found that many people are intimidated by the officers. They said that the internal affairs detectives treated them like suspects and like criminals, like they were lying to them, and that turned them off, and they stopped the process.
They went to court.
No, they stopped the process as far as filing the complaint, so the complaint never got followed through. And some of these officers have repeat instances like this, and nothing ever happens to them because of that. So the individual or resident files the report, it's investigated, and then if something happens to the officer, we'll never know because personnel laws shield all that information from the public.
You wrote, the law mandates that disciplinary actions against police go through a 3-person trial board, which makes decisions based on the preponderance of the evidence. Who makes up these boards in most cases?
That's changed recently. It's now officers within the command structure. They've changed it in Baltimore to where it's skewed towards management. And they're saying that they're crediting that for pushing these cases faster. They had a backlog of cases a few years ago, and they're moving those off the rolls now. So,
and is that that board, that 3-person board, part of the structure set up by the Police Bill of Rights?
Yes, that's mandated from that, and they have to follow that law.
The Baltimore Police Department's violent crime enforcement unit was the target of most of the citizen complaints that you reported on. Why do you think that unit was at the center of the city's police misconduct?
From everything I gleaned from talking to people who were familiar with that, including council members, crime had spiked back then. The prior commissioner wanted crime to come down. He gave this office, these units, leeway or power to go out and make crime go down. And they went out and they did that, but there was an after effect of heavy-handed tactics. And eventually, when Commissioner Batts took over in late 2012, he disbanded that unit.
So it's gone?
It's gone, but it's rebranded. It depends who you talk to. It's about half the size. It's called Special Enforcement Section now. And many of the same officers are still on it, but you still hear from people who says that they still do similar tactics or antics.
And looking at the current cases you've been looking at, does it show up there in the way that the old unit used to show up?
I haven't got that far running names through databases, but similar stuff has shown up.
That's Baltimore Sun investigative reporter Mark Puente here on Maryland Morning, WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about how the General Assembly may respond to Puente's reporting on brutality complaints against Baltimore police. So I gather the mayor and some legislators in Baltimore believe that the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights is too protective of police. What elements of the law are they concerned about?
They're concerned about the 10-day waiting period that officers have to obtain a lawyer when they're questioned in internal investigations. That's one of the biggest complaints. The mayor has said the police commissioner doesn't have the authority to discipline somebody or get them off the streets. If you go back to last summer when that individual officer was shown on the tape beating that suspect at a bus stop, they still had to pay him until he was charged with the crime. So sometimes they sit on a desk job or with no police powers for months. Some have sat there for years, still collecting a paycheck until they're charged with the crime. There's nothing they can do.
And I, believe me, as a citizen, I feel the frustration of that. But that inability to separate an officer from salary doesn't really keep the department from disciplining that officer.
Can't discipline them until that process has run its course. There's an administrative investigation, and then there's a criminal investigation. So the administrative one is not going to be done, or they're not going to finish that until the criminal side is done, so they can see how they match up to each other.
Do you have a sense of how the law in Maryland compares to elsewhere in the country?
Well, I found that a University of Maryland study, I think 10 or 12 years ago, showed that everybody but Rhode Island, Maryland is second to Rhode Island. Maryland is the second most restrictive or has the most protections for officers.
And so what kind of changes are being sought?
There's a lot of changes. They're all in discussions now. Delegates Anderson and Carter have kind of led this charge.
Delegate Kurt Anderson and Jill Carter.
They want to change that 10-day waiting period. They've held community meetings asking for input from residents before the session had started last week. And it's all on the table right now. Who knows where it'll go? Before any changes can be made, they've got to overcome powerful lobbyists from the Fraternal Order of Police, the State Police Chiefs Association, and the State Sheriff's Group, because they're all saying, which we've reported, that Baltimore's problems aren't occurring throughout the state and calls aren't being made from other people that they need to change this law.
So this is very much a Baltimore City Initiative
Correct.
In Annapolis
Correct.
To make changes.
If I can interrupt Delegate Joseph Valerio in charge of the House Judiciary Committee, who has to sign off on any of these changes, he had said when he was in Baltimore a few months ago, there won't be any carve-outs for Baltimore. It's going to be a one-size-fits-all, so it's got to apply statewide. That's a big hurdle to overcome. And they know that going into it.
Does the current law include citizen review, or is that part of what is being discussed?
That's one of the biggest issues that the critics of this law have talked about. They want more power to the civilian review boards to be able to offer discipline and be involved in the process. That's one of the biggest changes to come out of these community meetings legislators have held.
And the setup under the current law would not allow that as a local option?
They don't have much power, the current situation. And even the own board members have said that recently.
Is there a case that you covered in your review that sticks with you more than the others?
Probably the case of the 87-year-old grandmother, Venus Green. She called police saying her grandson had been shot. She needed help. Officers arrived at her house. The situation went bad. She says the officer handcuffed her, threw her against the wall, then picked her up, threw her against the room, handcuffed, yelled at her, called her derogatory terms. Not until their black officer showed up did they undo the handcuffs. And she sued, and they settled for, I think, $95,000 or $120,000, I think. That jumped out just for the fact of her age.
And do you have a sense from your reporting of I mean, we talked about, for example, that the unit that was at the center of many of the complaints has been disbanded. How else has the situation changed?
For that unit, they mandated that these officers cannot wear just jeans and T-shirts or sweatshirts. And another one of the cases that jumped out in the story was an officer got on the stand to testify and said he had this defendant or suspect in custody. He couldn't explain how his nose got smashed and why there's blood gushing from his face. He said maybe he poked himself in the eyes. This guy didn't know that these individuals were officers. They were wearing hooded sweatshirts and baseball caps and jeans. Now these officers have to wear insignia that label identify them police with badges, and they have much more tighter controls, according to the deputy police commissioner. So that's changed.
Another one of your stories pointed out that Baltimore City requires essentially people involved in settlements to keep quiet about them. Is that mandated by the state law, or is that only true in the city?
That's a city practice. As a reaction to our stories, talking about that non-disparagement clause, you accept a payment from the city, you say you'll never talk publicly to the media about the case. And a lot of people took issue with that clause because they're saying it's helped create this system of all these lawsuits and people aren't aware of this. And the mayor did come out and say that they're studying practices in other cities to see if it's a best practice. We did a story checking with similar-sized cities, and many cities do not have the similar practice. They don't put restrictions on people. Once they pay them the money for settlement, they're free to talk with whoever they want. And the mayor has vowed that if she finds similar comparisons, she will do away with that practice.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much. Mark Puente is a Baltimore Sun investigative reporter. At our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, we have links to some of his reporting on the Baltimore City Police. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on the show, we learn about blending old-time music and crankies. Then we'll know what a cranky is. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We would love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Joining me in the studio this morning, two musicians who specialize in old-time music. Anna Roberts-Givault and Elizabeth Laprelle will be performing ballads and old-time tunes at the Creative Alliance in Baltimore's Highland Town tomorrow night. They also make things called crankies, which are scrolling panoramas that they show while they perform. And on Sunday, they'll be teaching at a workshop at the Creative Alliance where families can learn how to make their own crankies. Good morning to you both. Thanks for coming.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
So in a minute, I'm going to ask you to tell us what a cranky is. But yeah. Anna, when you hear the term old-time music, what does that mean?
Well, it means a lot of things. But to us, I think it means the music that is still played and was played by people in rural Appalachia. And so sometimes that means gospel music. Sometimes it means ballads that are 400 years old. Sometimes it means fiddle tunes for square dances. And there are many different sub-styles of old-time music. But I think for us, the music we play is mountain music. And it's music from people that we've learned directly from older folks in the mountains, fiddle players and ballad singers. And also from recordings.
Yeah, nice. Well, as a friend of mine used to say, talking about music is like dancing about architecture.
Exactly.
So let's quit talking. And you guys, Anna, you've brought your guitar. And yeah. Elizabeth, you've got your banjo. Mm-hmm. You've been nice enough to do that. So why don't you play us a tune? What do you want to play?
This is Going Across the Mountain, and it's a song about a relative going off to the Civil War.
All right, great.
Going across the mountain, oh, very well. Going across the mountain, hear my banjo tell. I got my rations on my back, my powder, it is dry. I'm going across the mountain, Chrissy, don't you cry. I'm going across the mountain to join the boys in blue. When the war is over, I'll come back to you. I'm going across the mountain if I have to crawl. I'll give old Jeff's men a little of my rifle ball. Oh, way before it's good daylight, if nothing happens to me, oh, I'll be way down yonder in old Tennessee. Expect to miss me when I'm gone, but I'm going through. When the war is over, I'll come back to you. Going across the mountain, oh, very well. Going across the mountain, oh, very well. Going across the mountain, oh, very well. Gone across the mountain, oh, very well.
That's really lovely. Thank you so much. Anna Roberts-Givault on guitar, Elizabeth Laprelle on banjo, both on vocals. That's Going Across the Mountain. Example of the old-time music that you guys will be playing tomorrow night at the Creative Alliance. So, Elizabeth, you also involve these things called crankies in your show. So what's a cranky?
Yeah, I first found out about crankies from Anna, and they're a long scroll, either on paper or fabric, which you wind around two sticks, and then you put in a box, and you crank it so that you only see one part of the scroll at a time, and it's got pictures on it, so you crank it while you're singing or telling a story, and the pictures go along with the words.
Yeah, so like early TV,
right. Yeah.
Lo-fi music video. Cool.
Exactly.
So you'll be doing that tomorrow night at Creative Alliance?
Yeah. It's a whole festival of crankies. So yeah. there's
We got a number of other Baltimore artists to make a Cranky for the occasion. I think seeing a Cranky, part of what I think we both love about it is the ability to tell any story with it. So we're inspired to think of, wow, if we gave this challenge to these other artists that we love in Baltimore, what story would they pick? And we haven't seen them yet.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure.
But do you have tunes that fit to the stories that they were telling?
No, they're involving other musicians from Baltimore as well as other storytellers. So it's going to be a whole variety show night.
And everything about it, except our part, is going to be a surprise
for us.
For us.
And for the audience.
Yeah. Nice. That's good. Well, let me ask you to do another tune. You also do a lot of a cappella music together.
Yes, indeed.
Some fiddle music and stuff. So here's an a cappella tune you want to do called Long Time Traveling. What can you tell us about this song?
Well, we're really lucky to know a few wonderful folks whose families grew up with, played music. So one of those people is Rich Kirby, who's also a radio man down in Whitesburg, Kentucky. And his granny was an amazing ballad singer named Addie Graham. And this is just a little song that she sang.
Great. All right. So Long Time Traveling, Anna Roberts-Givault and Elizabeth Laprelle here in our studios on Maryland Morning.
Been a long time traveling, here below. Been a long time traveling away from my home. Been a long time traveling here below. To lay this body down. Been a long time traveling here below. Been a long time traveling away from my home. Been a long time traveling here below. To lay this body down. Been a long time traveling here below. Been a long time traveling away from my home. Been a long time traveling here below. To lay this body down.
That's really beautiful. Thank you so much. Long time traveling here in our studios, Anna Roberts-Givault and Elizabeth Laprelle. They'll be playing some old time music and singing some old time music tomorrow night at the Creative Alliance. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1. So, how do you learn the techniques? How do you learn the songs? Where do you find this stuff? Mm. You know, how do you get this show on the road?
Well, it's a great question.
I think for us it's definitely a mix of recordings and then friends.
Because it's certainly an oral tradition, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
do you,
if you hang out in the right places, in the right spots, and, you know, throughout the Appalachian Trail, you can probably hear a lot of folks still singing this music?
Yeah.
Some. Yeah, Elizabeth grew up in rural Retreat, Virginia, and I think was, I'm just going to tell your story, Elizabeth.
Do it.
But kind of like, it's an area where there's a lot of music. So, like, the barber in her town has instruments on his walls and kind of has helped a bunch of people Elizabeth's age kind of connect to the music. And there are fiddlers' conventions all throughout the summer. And so you can kind of, you start to meet the people that you want to learn from. So you hear someone sing at a festival and you kind of follow them around a lot. And and then if you become friends with them, they say, come to my house. And then sometimes they give you advice, but usually you just hang out and play or like watch TV shows with them or eat food or help them in their garden. Or it's kind of a whole experience. Like you learn some music, but you also learn about the whole picture.
Yeah, and Elizabeth, it's a growing community of folks doing this kind of music, the old-time music?
Well,
or a shrinking community?
I think it ebbs and flows. Mm-hmm. Like the time when this music was like the pop music of the day is long gone because that went away when the radio came. So curse you guys. No.
You're not the first.
Because
this was an entertainment in the days before sort of, you know, media, before broadcast media. Mm-hmm. But it's also the stories themselves get told. I mean, the Civil War, these were stories that were told through these songs. People learned about what was going on. They learned about, you know, certainly the hearts of people who were involved in these things.
Yeah, well, and the people I think who play it now are people who, for one reason or another, are interested in the old way of doing things, and that can take a lot of shapes. You know, some people who like this music really love old tools, and to them the music is like an artifact, and they just like the way things used to be done, and the music is part of that. Some people like it because it's, you know, they feel like it's just fun they can have with their family, you know, mm-hmm. just sit around and play with their uncles and their cousins and their
which Elizabeth does
kids. Some people come to it just because, really, musically, it speaks to them, mm-hmm. and strikes a chord. So, yeah.
So Elizabeth, you're still living in Southwest Virginia, right? And Anna, you're here in Baltimore.
Yeah.
Right? Is there much of an old time music community right here in the city?
Yeah, there is. There's a lot of places to hear various forms of folk music. I kind of moved to Baltimore out of an interest of really, I guess, more tying into, I guess, music that is new. I spent a bunch of time living in the country and was learning about music that was kind of an older form of music. And I think Baltimore is a really exciting place to live musically because there is a lot of interest in cross-collaboration across, you know, like hanging out with friends who do the Baltimore Boom Bap Society who are saying, hey, we're curious about kind of what old-time music can bring to this scene, or I guess I was interested in what old-time music had to do with the present.
Mm-hmm. Do either of you play other genres as well? I mean, or do you concentrate all of your musical activity in the old-time genre?
I don't anymore. Now that I'm living in Baltimore.
What brought you to it? I mean, you talked about what brings audiences to it that wonderful scene that we can all conjure in our heads of a family sitting around after dinner, you know, singing tunes just for hours and hours and hours. And having done that myself with friends and parties, you know, over the years, it's a great, comforting, wonderful thing to do. But is that the kind of that scene, Elizabeth, is that what drew you to it?
Yeah, well, I did grow up in a musical family, and my family was interested in old music, folk music, music of all kinds, but they really liked music they could make themselves sitting around. So I came up with that growing up, and then in my teens, I really started, like, artistically, it started to speak to me in a huge way.
Mm-hmm.
And it became something I really wanted to follow.
And it's interesting when you share this, like tomorrow night, you share this in a concert format. Mm-hmm. A lot of this music doesn't have really a concert profile. It has, it's a much more intimate, like in the room kind of profile.
Totally.
So it gets a little complicated when you have to translate it on a stage.
Well, I think Cranky's helps that's why, with that.
Yeah. I think when we first met and we were talking about ways to explore, like to get an audience to get into the stories as much as we both are into the story part. And I think some bands do this by creating these really lush, like, you know, arrangements of a song or a ballad to help show the arc. And for us, we want to just keep the singing simple and then to get the audience into the story by giving them something to look at or to say, right, that's the Turkish lady.
Mm-hmm.
That's just this character.
To bring you into the world,
mm-hmm.
The imaginative world that the songs are creating.
All right, so let me ask you to play one more tune as you go out. Anna Roberts-Gavalt and Elizabeth Leprell, they'll be performing some old-time music and showing some old-time Crankies tomorrow night at 8 o'clock at the Creative Alliance in East Baltimore. And on Sunday afternoon, they'll offer a workshop for kids and families on how to make Crankies. Their new album is called Anna and Elizabeth. It'll be available March 17th. We've got a link to more information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. So what do you want to play for us as we go out?
This is a tune called Little Black Train.
Little Black Train. All right, it's great to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
God sent Hezekiah a message from on high. You better get your house in order, for you must surely die. He turned to the wall of weeping. We see him there in tears. He got his business fixed all right. God spared him 15 years. There's a little black dream coming. Fix all your business right. All dressed in worldly pride, the Death Star train's coming, prepare to take a ride. I see the train with the engine and one small baggage car. Your idle thoughts, wicked deeds, will stop at judgment bar. There's a little black train to come in, fix all your business right. There's a little black train to come in, and it could be here tonight. That poor young man in darkness cares not for the gospel light, till suddenly hears a whistle blow and a little black train. Oh Lord, won't you please spare me? I see my wicked flight. Have mercy, Lord, upon me. Please come and set me right. There's a little black train to come in. Fix all your business right.
Is there an issue in Maryland that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Now, back to the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us this morning. The local novelist and poet Charles Rammelkamp has published a new chapbook of poems called Mixed Signals. He's a former adjunct member of the English faculty at Essex Community College and the author of short story collections, essays, poems, and a novel called The Secret Keepers. And this morning, Charles Rammelkamp joins me in the studio. Good to see you. How you doing?
Hi, very well. Thank you.
Good. So Mixed Signals is the name of the book, and there's a photograph which was taken in the mid-1950s, and there's Sophia Loren staring at Jane Mansfield. They're at a table at probably a restaurant. Both of them two very, you know, beautiful, buxom women, and Miss Lorenz is looking at the cleavage of Miss Mansfield. And so the title of the book is Mixed Signals, and how did you pick that particular photograph to be on the cover?
It seemed like such an iconic image of mixed signals. There's Lorenz looking very apprehensive and a little withdrawn, I would suppose, and Mansfield very vivacious, exhibitionistic, and you know, of course, one's brunette, one's blonde, so there's another kind of contrast.
How does it relate to your poem of the same name and to this collection in general?
Well, the title poem is Mixed Signals. It has nothing to do with Lorraine and Mansfield, but I chose the poems in this collection. You know, you sometimes see collections, selected poems of so-and-so or selected short stories. Mm-hmm. Selected these poems on the theme of mixed signals, which is very broad. I mean, irony is all about mixed signals, and irony is sort of a staple of poetry and literature. So it may be a little loose, but I think it's very cohesive.
Well, let me ask you to read the title poem. It's on page 7 of the new book. Describes an incident that involves a little boy, which we're assuming is you. But why don't you read it for us? Mixed Signals.
Back in the 60s, when everybody smoked cigarettes, my pixie-ish blonde Aunt Sally, fresh from the shower, a towel wrapped about her, modest but provocative, sprayed her hair, Alberto VO5, a butt dangling from her mouth. The hairspray ignited, her head a halo of fire. She screamed, the smoke rolling under the vanity, her towel falling away. 8 years old, I stood outside the bathroom, door half open, watching my aunt grab the towel, smother her head as if in some crazy purification rite, killing the flames before any serious damage. Just a kid who assumed all endings were happy, I howled the sight, my naked aunt, towel over her head like a shroud, fear distorting her features. Aunt Sally's open hand caught me across the cheek, knocking me backward. Recovering her composure, she pulled me to her, pressing my face against her naked breasts, the confusing scent of singed hair, tobacco, her sex wafting up from her lap as I watched the small flame from the linoleum under the vanity where the cigarette had rolled.
Charles Rammelkamp from his new chapbook of poetry, reading the title cut, as it were, Mixed Signals. Did that actually happen to you when you were a little kid?
Not really, no. Mm-hmm.
So a lot of these poems, there are a bunch that we actually can't have you read on the radio. there's a preoccupation, it seems to me, with sex and with sexuality. Is that a theme
well,
of other
a lot,
work of yours?
I've been accused of having a dirty mind. I'm in a dirty mouth. But it's sort of a rich source for mixed signals, I guess. But I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Well, it just seems like it's a thread throughout the whole collection that there's a sort of sexual tension or a sexual illusion in almost every poem here. That's kind of
true. I was kind of wondering what I could read here on the radio show.
Not a whole lot. I did find another one. It's called Tiger's Fan. It's on page 13, and this is a very touching poem, I thought.
It's the damn timing belt. Ricky's voice rose like an albatross at sea, above the ruptured sound of something gone wrong under the hood, a noise like surf breaking against the rocks. We sailed into the shoulder, a rudderless boat on a calm day, 5 lanes of cars and trucks cruising past us like oil tankers. There's a service station over there. My son pointed to the exit, like a shipwrecked sailor spotting land. We waited for a break in the traffic before dashing across the asphalt. When we made the other side, my Colorado Rockies cap flew off my head, crazy as a wayward gull. Ricky started after it. He'd given it to me for my birthday almost a decade before. The initials on the cap matched my own. I grabbed his arm. "Let it go," I shouted over the foghorn of a 16-wheeler. I hated to lose that cap, felt a sharp pang of loss as I watched it sail away like a bottle with a message in it. But it wasn't worth the risk. I'm a Tigers fan anyway.
Tigers Fan, read by Charles Rammelkamp, my guest this morning here on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1. You're also an editor of a literary journal, an online literary journal called The Potomac, and you've recently retired from a full-time, non-poet job. What's your take of the literary scene from the vantage point of a person who's published some work, some poems and some essays and a novel, but, looking to do that now full-time now that you've punted your day job, as it were?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to be involved with the Potomac. I get to meet a lot of writers. It's sponsored by the Algonquian Writing Seminars. I'm currently working on a collection of poems about William Jennings Bryan, which was one that I had started about, several years ago. And then because of my job, I didn't really have time to concentrate. And I sort of thought it had died on the vine, but it's something I'm really enjoying working on right now.
Yeah. What was your job, your full-time job? Did it involve writing?
Yeah, I was worked at the Social Security Administration. I worked on disaster recovery plans and a lot of written procedures and documentation.
Mm-hmm. So obviously not poetic writing, not creative fiction and that sort of thing. Has making that transition been difficult? But
no, not
fun?
At all. It's been very nice. Sometimes I wake up in the morning thinking that somebody's going to snatch it all away from me.
Yeah. Because, a lot of the folks that I talk to who come on the show, writers who at various points in their careers talk about Baltimore as being a really great town for writers, a really great literary scene. You've got guys like Greg Wilhelm and the City Lit Project, promoting promoting and advocating for writers. Has that been your personal experience?
Yes. I sorely miss Minas's gallery closing down. It was a great reading space for local poets and writers.
He was over in Hamden on the Avenue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now there's
But many others have cropped up since.
Yeah. There's, in fact, the Litmore has moved from Mount Washington to Keswick Road. And so that's in Hamden also.
And do you have a reading coming up pretty soon?
I do, down at the Watermark Gallery, which is at sort of Charles and Lombard, I think, in the Watermark Gallery in the Bank of America building at Manzar Azuli's Watermark Gallery.
Uh-huh. And when will that reading take place?
That will be Sunday at 2,
uh-huh.
Sunday the 25th.
Now, here's a poetry reading series in a bank building. I mean, that's really quite something. I mean, that's, I think, kind of indicative of what's going on in the literary scene here in Baltimore.
That's true.
Good. Well, good luck with the new book and good luck with the reading on Sunday. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Charles Rammelkamp. The new chapbook is called Mixed Signals. It's published by Finishing Line Press. We've got a link to more information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, including information about Charles's reading coming up on Sunday. That's it for us this morning. Coming up Monday, a conversation with Wes Moore, the author of The Other Wes Moore. He's written a new memoir that takes up where his first bestseller left off, and we'll also speak with Dr. Lena Wen. She's the new head of the Baltimore City Health Department. Until then, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great weekend.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Estelle Klein
and Catherine Sway.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. On the web at zekescoffee.com.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1789, John Carroll, first bishop of the Catholic Diocese of Baltimore, founded Georgetown University along the Potomac River in what was Maryland at the time. We're back Monday. Please join us.